to this Food for Faith. Well, I suppose it's a special, really, because we received this morning, New Zealand time, the news that Pope Emeritus Benedict has died, which we were expecting for some time. He was 95, and we knew in the last few days from Pope Francis that he was very unwell. So I thought it would be a good idea to just have a conversation with a couple of friends.
Kia ora tātou katoa. I'm Sian Owen. I'm a sister of St. Joseph that serves in the Auckland Diocese.
Right, I suppose that means your qualification for being here, Sian, is that you're a sister of St. Joseph, and we're talking about Joseph Ratzinger.
I think also there's the fact that I, like every other person in the church, was a member of the faithful at a time when Benedict was the Pope. And so, therefore, I have lived experience of his pontificate.
Indeed. Indeed.
Hi, Father Merv Duffy, Marist priest lecturing in theology in Auckland at the Catholic Theological College.
It's a difficult time of the year to get people together. I had visions of having four or five people together for this conversation, but at a few hours' notice, it's a bit difficult, but I thought a good way for us to start might be to say, you know, what's one way that that's what one thing that we're grateful to Benedict, to Joseph Ratzinger for?
I think the pontificate of Benedict for me can tell us a lot about our use of media and technology. So Benedict was really the first pope we knew about when he became Pope, and perhaps in many ways the only one, because we didn't know a lot about our current Pope. And so he presented himself before the crowds of St. Peter as Joseph Ratzinger, and we thought, oh, we know what this pontificate's going to be like. We could put him in a box because we'd read about him or heard about him. And so for me, his legacy is that in many ways he defied what we thought we were getting. He surprised us, and I think he truly surprised me personally in his humility. And a personal experience of that for me was when we were gathered as Sisters of St. Joseph in the Chapel of Mary MacKillop in Sydney in 2008 at the time of World Youth Day, and he came into the chapel to pray at the tomb. We'd been given all these instructions about what we could and couldn't do and how many feet away we had to be from him. And he just humbly just pushed that all aside and was this wonderful, warm pastor with the people, clasping sisters' hands, talking to them, just being a humble presence. And we were all hyped up, and he was just taking it very calmly and things. And I think you see that in his writing sometimes, particularly, you know, God is Love, where he talks about being in the presence of this immense love and being humble in that. And, you know, at that time he was called the Green Pope. You know, we talk about Laudato Si, but that is based on his work, and Francis talks about that in the beginning of it. So that humility, and ultimately saw him resign.
Sian, I think you've given us a great introduction there, because as you say, he was the first pope we thought we knew when he became pope. Like John Paul was an unknown, and Francis we didn't know at all. But we'd known Benedict as Joseph Ratzinger for 25 years, and I remember the surprise, the shock, the even the horror at the time of his election, because people thought, well, we know what he's like. But it's very interesting that his first homily as Pope, which I'll attach to this link because I think it's so powerful, he certainly refers to John Paul, but it's one of the most tender, beautiful pieces of writing. Each of us is loved, each of us is necessary, each of us is essential. And that was in April of 2005. And then we awaited, of course, his first encyclical. And I imagine if you're 78 when you're elected, as he was, you think, well, I might only have one chance to put out an encyclical, so what's it going to be? It's going to be the most important thing. And Sian, you've referred to it. God is Love. So on Christmas Day of that first year, this encyclical was published, a beautiful reflection on love. And I remember reading a few days after it was published a media comment, and it was a woman who was writing, I think, for The Guardian in England, and she was really wanting to tear this guy apart. Like, he was the guy that, you know, was the defender of the doctrine of the faith. And so as she started to write, it was clear as we were reading it, she was trying to tear it apart. And in the end, in this writing, she kind of gives up and says, look, it's very clear that this letter was written by a man who knows how to love. And she just left it at that.
To come back to your original question of things that we're grateful to Benedict for, right back when he was the cardinal in charge of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and he was sort of the guard dog of orthodoxy for his friend, Pope John Paul II. I was a student in Rome doing my doctoral thesis, and I made a radical choice for one of the thinkers I was dialoguing with. I wrote about Jürgen Habermas, who is a German neo-Marxist sociologist who isn't very positive about the Catholic Church. So, you know, getting this past one's examiners at in a defense in the Gregorian University slightly concerned me. Just before I was, well, in my last year of writing this, Benedict had a public debate with Jürgen Habermas. So if it was good enough for the Cardinal of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to dialogue with the ideas of Jürgen Habermas, then it was fine for a little doctoral student to do the same. So that's my personal thing to be grateful to Benedict for. But it was, as Sian said, the picture that we had of him at the time he was elected Pope was of the guard dog. There was there's a communist newspaper in Rome, and the day he was elected as Pope, they got a slightly unflattering picture of him on the balcony with his arms raised, which Italians sort of react against, and they gave the headline "Il Pastore Tedesco," the German Shepherd, again picking up the guard dog idea, and that was the rep he had coming in. And it was fascinating how the media narrative didn't want to change.
Indeed. And do you know how it is very unfair, like a comparison's often made between Francis and Benedict. And I have this little exercise that I often do with people. I reflected on it in this morning's homily. I put up a picture of John Paul and Benedict and Francis, and then I put some quotes and I say, match the quotes with the Pope. And everyone gets the John Paul ones right, because if they don't understand that it's probably John Paul, it needs a team of theologians to unpack it. But Benedict and Francis in their writing are extraordinarily similar. Benedict's writing is a lot more concise and precise. And maybe that's a German cultural thing, whereas Francis can take a lot of words to say something. But the same kind of tenderness or intimacy, particularly when talking about God, is present. And I wonder if the media presentations of we love Francis and like Benedict is simply because Benedict is an introvert. Benedict was an introvert and Francis is an extrovert. Francis does the one-liners and... whereas Benedict was a shy man, thought very carefully before he spoke. And it's interesting that the times when he moved out of the Pope role, there are two or three lectures that he gave, which he returned to Regensburg, and he'd been Pope for, I think, 6 or 7 years when he returned to his old university where he used to teach before John Paul brought him to Rome. And he gave a lecture in which he quoted someone who spoke about what the Muslim people, what the Muslim people had brought to the world. And he was quoting someone.
And it was an ancient quote.
It was an ancient quote. That's right. So he was quoting someone else, and he wasn't speaking as Pope. He was simply giving an academic lecture at your old university where you think you're among friends. And it just, it exploded. Like, people immediately thought, they didn't understand that he was quoting something that had been written several hundred years earlier, and they blamed him for the statement. But this, again, Sian, you mentioned his humility. The following audience, as soon as he got back to Rome, he apologized. He apologized for the confusion, the hurt that this had caused. And perhaps this is one of the things that I always admired him for, is that it seems to me that previous popes, John Paul included and further back, would only ever quote the people who were respected saints or fathers, literally, of the church, with a few exceptions, the doctors who, among whom were some women. But Ratzinger would quote absolutely everyone, and his books are full of quotes of people who are supportive of Christian faith, who are strongly opposed to it. And you only need to pick up any of his books to see this all the way through, the name dropping absolutely anyone who's trying to bring an intelligent contribution to the conversation. A wonderful, open quality.
And I think picking up on that extroverted introvert, Benedict, since he retired, has spoken about that difference, that he admired Francis's ability to be with people. And, you know, he felt that maybe he stayed in his head, which is an academic's trend, isn't it? And apparently before he was elected, he said, "I'm no administrator." You know, he was very aware of his own frailty as a human being, with even within the role.
And Sian, you've mentioned witnessing that. Like, that sounds like a fairly intimate gathering, just with the sisters at the tomb of Mary MacKillop.
Yeah, it was.
Merv, do you remember when you were in his presence?
I never got as close to Pope Benedict as Sister Sian did. I saw him in the hall of Paul VI with other students of the Gregorian University. And I was a concelebrant at the Mass he preached at for the first of the 9 days of mourning for Pope John Paul II. He was enormously impressive in that period of time after the death of John Paul, and gave a remarkably warm homily about him. And this idea of John Paul II looking down from a window in heaven, which was a very odd thing for a systematic theologian to effectively canonize somebody straight off.
I remember his homily at the funeral of John Paul. He said he referred to John Paul as having returned to the Father's house. But then looking down, as you say, Merv, looking down from the window of heaven. Remember the homily that he gave? Well, it was interesting because he was the Dean of the College of Cardinals. When John Paul died, he kind of took the lead, and he was the one who celebrated the funeral mass for John Paul. And then he was also the one who gave a pretty memorable speech to the cardinals before they went into conclave. And it seems to me it was the kind of speech, if you're a politician, this is the kind of speech you'd give if you were desperate to not get the job. He spoke about relativism, which was a recurring theme of his. And he would often talk about without an objective truth, we're all at sea, where everything is as good as anything else, which he called relative, which he spoke of as relativism. And it meant that we were kind of rudderless in an ocean, like those who don't have a faith are often left at sea. But he didn't therefore emphasize a church or a Catholic position, because he, in a lot of his writing, would talk about, while we might believe something because we have heard or think God says it, he would say, there's another way to the truth as well, and that's through reason. So if you are, if you seek to be completely reasonable, then that will lead you to the truth, which is where we meet God. So in this speech, he wasn't saying it's important to believe. He was saying, be fully human, live your humanity. And if you believe that A or B or C will lead you to complete happiness, you not only have an opportunity, but almost a responsibility to follow that in a way that is reasonable, because that will lead you to an encounter with Christ. Anyhow, after giving this speech, which I think I've summarized very badly there, 2 days later, after four ballots, he was elected as Pope.
One of the things, surprising things he did in his pontificate was publish the volumes of Jesus of Nazareth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given that, and this relates, I think, a bit to your introvert and reason thing, where John Paul II visited places and did things and interacted with huge audiences. Benedict didn't enjoy that and didn't see that as the priority. Mm. And he said that his first concern was to present people with the person and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth so that they could have a relationship with him. So it was very much Benedict wanted to be out of the way to let people meet Jesus.
And that was the core, as I understand it, he was of his teaching. And he had a long teaching career. I mean, we could say 70 years, really, from the time he was ordained a priest in his early 20s, really through to his death, even the last 10 fairly silent years. But Jesus Christ was the center of his teaching in every way. The relationship with Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ was the center of his teaching in every way, but not just Jesus Christ as an historical figure, but as the living person with whom we are called into relationship. And it's that relationship, he often said, that makes abundant human living possible. And only that relationship that makes abundant human living possible.
And of course, he had a link with Guardini, and he was very much in favor of communio e liberazione, communion and liberation.
Indeed, indeed. So much so that, and for those who don't know, communion and liberation is one of the new movements. Luigi Tassani was a good friend of Joseph Ratzinger. And in fact, when Tassani died in February of 2005, the same year that John Paul died. So Tassani died in February of 2005, and it was arranged that Cardinal Ratzinger would preach at Tassani's funeral in Milan. But in many ways, they did speak the same language. I mean, little did we know that just 4 months later, Cardinal Ratzinger would be Pope Benedict. But encounter with Christ, that was central. And my sense is that if we were to summarize all of the work, the writing, the teaching, the ministry, the life of Benedict Joseph Ratzinger in one sentence, it would have to include the phrase personal relationship with Jesus Christ, who is God with us. I'm just trying to find a quote here. So Shan, you brought us to his first encyclical in December of 2005, and this is a quote. I love this, because we'd often think the defender of the doctrine of the faith guy, well, he's going to be big about the rules and the ethics. This is what he said in Deus Caritas Est. He says, being Christian is not the result of an ethical choice or a lofty idea, but the encounter with an event, a person, the person of Jesus Christ, who gives life a new horizon and a decisive direction. Isn't that a great quote? Being Christian is not about, it's not an ethical choice or a lofty idea. It's about the relationship with Christ.
And I think because of that, we do often think of him as being legally bound and things like that, particularly because of his past life as Cardinal Ratzinger, if you like. But when you read what he writes about calling people to an ethical stance It isn't because there's a law. It's because it frees people to be in relationship. And I think his speech to the UK Parliament is actually quite extraordinary, because he's saying, basically, there was a financial crisis because we forgot about relationships, you know, and how humans need to be able to be in relationship with whoever they call God. And he was quite open that it be beyond the Christian narrative, but also with each other, because that's where they find God.
Well, Sean, we'll attach a link to that speech. But as you mentioned the UK Parliament, I'm thinking of a speech he gave to the German Parliament. He was speaking about how to make laws, because what he had noticed happening in Germany, as in other parts of the world, is that laws were being made by a democratic decision. So, of course, we go back to the dangers of relativism here. Anything goes, who votes for most, that's what our new law is. And what he said is, without the bigger picture, who he then, of course, understands to be God, we again don't know what to decide. It just becomes fashion. Like, law is reduced to fashion or personal preferences of this moment, which is tragic for people. But that was a speech also that he got to the German Parliament that he got a lot of flack for.
I'm just thinking, even his choice of name, choosing Benedict, as, you know, Saint Benedict, the great monastic founder, the idea of a rule of life that leads to holiness, and this keeping ideas and faith and civilization alive in Europe, and one of the patrons of Europe. There was in many ways, Benedict was a pope for Europe, and trying to teach and proclaim Jesus Christ in what had been the heartland of Christianity, but in many ways, your relativism or secularism has dramatically changed those cultures.
Of course, as Sisters of St. Joseph, our friend Joseph Ratzinger did canonise Mary of the Cross, so
there's something to be grateful for.
So, Sean, what you're about to say is that therefore you're quite biased.
Yes. But, I mean, he was the first person to, in the Eucharistic prayer, name Mary of the Cross as Saint Mary of the Cross, because it happened in the mass of the canonization. But even there, again, you know, this small, frail man just holding people in awe, not because of his person, but because of his prayer. You know, he really got the sense that he was praying Mass with us. He wasn't saying Mass for us.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real gift of any pastor, to be in a place where you're with the people, even though you might be physically distanced, but by your mannerism. He held our postulator's hand and shook it like this and said something very quiet that she's never revealed, but that brought her great solace. But, you know, we all saw it, that personal touch.
You remind me, Sean, and Merv, you referred to it, you implied it before, that I remember hearing after he was elected, people used to go to Rome to see John Paul, but they went to Rome to hear Benedict. And again, as you said, Merv, you know, Benedict, it was very clear he didn't like the limelight. Like, he didn't like being the centre. John Paul, it really seemed to give him energy. He seemed to play off it and thrive on it. I was only in the presence of Benedict the 16th once, and it was at the final Mass for the year of priests, and I've forgotten the year that it was. But I remember one evening, and there were 15,000 priests in St. Peter's Square. That's a big number, but we were really only in a very small corner of the square, which can hold an extraordinary number of people. And we were there to hear there was Eucharistic adoration and reflections from three or four priests from different parts of the world and from people on video links speaking about priesthood. And then Pope Benedict came out for the Eucharistic adoration, and then he sat there and we were ready to hear him speak. And he took out a little pile of papers, which was clearly his speech. And then he, from the speech, you know, warmly greeted us. And then something seemed to happen. I mean, we were really hanging on every word. It was the evening. It was dark. There was sort of a dimmed lighting. It was a beautiful atmosphere. And I remember this. He rolled up the pages and just held them in his hand like a scroll and just thought a bit and then just spoke to us as if we were two or three people in a room. It was one of, I remember looking around and seeing the other priests who were there, just their mouths falling open and leaning forward and really listening. And one of the things, if I can share what he said, we still don't know, or I don't know what was in his written notes or what kind of brilliant speech he was going to give. But the one thing he left us with, and he spoke about in all kinds of ways from all different aspects over the next half hour, was you guys are not the Messiah. And the implications of that are huge. It's like we sat there relaxing. That's right. He's right. We're not the Messiah. Sometimes we think we are, perhaps. Sometimes the people expect us to be, but we're not the Messiah. Just remember this. But stay close to the Messiah. It was the most powerful experience. And we couldn't even see, like he was a little dot there in the distance. So it wasn't that we were there to see him. But once he spoke, oh my goodness, we listened. Changed our lives, I think. Certainly mine.
You spoke of people coming to Rome to hear Benedict after coming to see John Paul. John Paul II, if he hadn't become a priest, wanted to be an actor. Benedict, he was going to be a university man. He was going to be a lecturer. And he was a very good lecturer. John Paul worked a crowd, was an extrovert, is amazing when you saw him in action. Benedict, much more a man of ideas, much more a man of words. The clarity and simplicity and directness of his writing as pontiff was wonderful for those of us whose job it is to read the stuff that comes out from Rome. He was way easier to understand than John Paul II. Pope Francis has more of the John Paul II ability to make the dramatic gesture. He works in symbols rather than in words. And he also knows how media works, is aware of public perceptions, I think, in a way that maybe Benedict wasn't. Benedict, in a sense, wanted to be invisible and just get the ideas across that I'm presenting to you Jesus Christ. Like, Benedict didn't want to be seen acting in any role other than as Pope, because it was only as Pope that he felt he had a role. You know, you wouldn't see photos of him skiing or doing activities, you know, hobby activities or anything other than his official job. And he was very clear he was not the Messiah.
I think he's, you often hear in traditional circles, Joseph hidden and unknown. And I think that his life, that's really kind of what he was seeking, you know. He was the follower of Christ. He was the supporter of the church, but in simple and quiet ways would have been his preference, maybe rather than the stage of the pontificate. And yet, despite that, was willing to say yes when he was called to that role. And maybe that's a lesson for us all, that we're not always called according to what the norms might suggest. He was called to be the Pope that we needed at the time. We believe in the role of the Holy Spirit in the whole election of the Pope.
And he was also the Pope who decided to resign while he was still in reasonably good health. And so he gave us a 9-year pontificate, and we then he stepped aside. And you talk about Saint Joseph of the scriptures never getting a single line of dialogue in the Gospels. When he stepped aside, the Catholic Church didn't know what to do with an ex-pope. Should he wear white? What is his title? Where should he live? What should he do? And it would have been so easy for him to become a center of opposition if the new pontiff had ideas that were different or did anything that people disliked. They would have looked to the past pontiff and tried to drive a wedge between the two of them. And so he chose to live basically a monastic life inside the Vatican and to be virtually completely silent.
Yes.
And I think those 9 years of silence speak loudly.
Yes, indeed. Because you're right, Merv, like he was the one who very simply said, this is how we'll do it. And he was right. Like if he'd decided to go home to Germany, a second Vatican would have opened up for some people in Germany. Like there would have been that the opposition would have happened, but he knew that the best way was to be right there. And Francis really seemed to welcome him, calling him from the first day. It's like having a grandfather just across the fence. A wise
somebody you can talk to about what the job is like.
That's right, which is not what usually happens. Look, I'm very aware we could talk for a long time, and we'll talk for a little while yet. But I don't think we can let this conversation go without talking about liturgy, and because many will summarize Benedict's life, not just his papacy, but his life as being centered on the liturgy. And of course, there are many things that he emphasized in liturgy and other things he didn't talk about. But what would you say, each of you, about Benedict and liturgy?
This is another one where reputation matters and expectation matters. As soon as he was elected, the garments available in liturgy shops in Rome became more traditional, more conservative, lots more lace. There was an expectation that Benedict was going to try and bring things back to an older style. Mm. And in many ways, he did. He was somebody who believes in continuity and organic development in the life of the church. And he was very keen to avoid schism in the church. And a lot of the fight in the church, well, the most dangerous schism in the church was between those who felt that the Tridentine liturgy was the only true liturgy. And so he issued the motu proprio that allowed the celebration of that form of the liturgy. And that was an attempt to hold the church in unity.
Mm.
And because he felt it was a treasure of the past that could be lost.
As I was doing work on the synod, particularly on the synthesis parts that we've done, I was really aware of what Benedict had done, because there's a great call by the church across the globe, as we see in the Continental Phase booklet, for inclusion. And I think what I learned from Benedict and what challenged me as I was doing that, that means to include everybody, including those that might want something that a large portion think is wrong. How do we welcome those people that still think the Latin Mass is the end all and be all, as well as those who are calling for a radical reform of the liturgy? Because I think that's what Benedict was about, holding unity. I personally struggle with some of his liturgical implementations, you know, the translation, the retranslation of the liturgy into the literal form rather than the dynamic form. I, I struggle with, but I understand that what was done was so that there was a sense of continuity and a sense of inclusion.
Shan, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. His prime motivation wasn't some kind of nostalgia for what had been, but it was the unity of the church. And he'd lived through and been active in those years after the council when it seemed that everything that was good in liturgy, or everything that had nourished the faith of the saints of the church and our grandparents and our families, had been put aside, being abrogated, being stopped. And in fact, there was a time after the council in the late 1960s when the vernacular liturgy came in English in, I think, 69, the Tridentine form was not able to be celebrated, and whole monasteries which had given their existence to that form of the liturgy, many of them very loyally, changed to the Novus Ordo, the Mass that we're more familiar with now. But he then saw over the years that that became divisive, which is why 2007, I think, Summorum Pontificum, which is the motu proprio that you refer to, Merv, allowing widespread use of the, what he then called, not the Tridentine Mass, but the extraordinary form. So there's the ordinary form and the extraordinary form. But I think if, as the years went on, it did become divisive. I think we are aware in some of our dioceses here in Aotearoa that the two forms of liturgy are not operating as two lungs of the one liturgy yet. We've got a lot more work to do there. And it's very interesting, you know, some people, and perhaps particularly some priests, say Mass should be celebrated ad orientem, facing the east as it always was. People simply call it priest back to people Mass. And he was asked about this. He said, should we bring in ad orientem, like all Masses, even in English, are celebrated ad orientem? And he said, no, that would be divisive. So we don't do that, because actually that's not the key point. The key point is the unity of the liturgy, again, as you say, Sean. And you mentioned earlier, Merv, Romato Guardini, who wrote a little book in 1918 called The Spirit of the Liturgy. Guardini was a great teacher, not only of Benedict, but also of John Paul and Francis, because he inspired that whole generation and through the seminaries. But 80 years later, Joseph Ratzinger wrote a book that he gave the same title, The Spirit of the Liturgy. Because the liturgy, he said, if we get the liturgy right, everything else in the church will fall into place. But the liturgy is central. In his catechism, which he wrote in the late 1960s, it's called Introduction to Christianity. It's a wonderful book that I've only gone back to in the last few months. He says that we Christians find ourselves in the position of the circus clown. He said, imagine the circus comes to town and they set up their campus just neighboring the village, and a fire starts in the circus in one of the tents. So the manager of the circus looks around and, who can I send to warn the villagers? And he grabs the clown, who's ready to go on stage, and he says to the clown, look, the performance here is cancelled, the place is burning down, you must run and tell the villagers that the circus is on fire, they've got to evacuate the village. So the clown runs to the village in full clown gear and tells the people, the circus is on fire, it's going to spread, your village is going to burn down, run for safety. And the people clap and cheer and laugh, and he gets more insistent. No, no, really, really, the circus is on fire. And they laugh and they clap even harder. And the story that he tells in the catechism, in the Introduction to Christianity, is the whole place burnt down, village and circus, and people were burned. And we as Christians find ourselves in this position where we're like the clown. People think, they're Catholics, they're Christians, we know what they think. And they kind of laugh. It's going to be irrelevant. And they don't clap and cheer us, of course, but they just ignore. And I think that's a wonderful image. We find ourselves in that position. So what we've got to say is not just important, but essential, says Ratzinger. But how do we communicate this in a way people have attached too much baggage to the image that we present. It's a challenge.
I think we can't. We may have covered this, but you know, we can't talk about Ratzinger's legacy without mentioning his resignation as being a truly pivotal point in the life of the church. You know, his humility to resign while he had the capacity to make that, his willingness to show the very thing that he might have been known as sticking to the norm and what's happened in the past, popes don't resign. You know, that would be the narrative of 99.9% of the thing, for him to say that there are circumstances, a time comes when actually what we've taken as being normative needs to change. And this is one of them.
Especially, Sian, as he was following John Paul, who was very elderly, could hardly move and couldn't speak. And when it was suggested that John Paul resign, John Paul said, "You don't come down from the cross." So here we've got Pope Benedict following that and had no hesitation, it seemed, to, as he predicted 3 years before he resigned, when a pope gets to the stage where he cannot function adequately to govern the church, he not only can resign, he has a responsibility to resign.
And then doing it in a way where people went, "Huh? What? I think has he resigned? I think he must have had a wee chuckle about that."
You've seen the two popes.
Oh, yeah, I have, but not from that. But, you know, just the way he did it and when he did it, you know, you can imagine people going, "Is that really what he said?"
So maybe just to bring our conversation to a conclusion, and people will have their own conversations, I'm sure, and we may even have more of these conversations, what would you like, each of you, Merv and Sian, what would you like to see Benedict remembered for?
I'd like to see Benedict remembered for his teaching, his writing, his ideas, and for his presenting the importance of the relationship with Jesus Christ.
And I'd like to see him remembered for his humility and his willingness to do something that was difficult for him, because he wasn't a natural extrovert, because he was responding to a call of the Holy Spirit.
Oh, that was so good, Sian. You topped me so magnificently there. That was really good.
Okay, well, with those two wonderful comments, I'm not even going to try and beat those comments. I just thought we might draw this to a conclusion, with Benedict letting him speak for himself. And I remember at his inauguration mass, I think they call it the inauguration mass, and this is in April of 2005, his first mass as Pope. And I get to the time of his homily, and he gives a reflection about the fisherman's ring that he wears. And then he moves to a different phase of it, and he says this in the homily. And I think it's some of the most beautiful spiritual writing I've ever read. He says this: "Only when we meet the living God in Christ do we know what life is. We are not some casual and meaningless product of evolution. Each of us is the result of a thought of God. Each of us is willed. Each of us is loved. Each of us is necessary. There is nothing more beautiful than to be surprised by the gospel, by the encounter with Christ. There is nothing more beautiful than to know him and to speak to others of our friendship with him. Since God has first loved us, love is no longer a mere command. It is the response to the gift of love with which God in Jesus Christ draws near to us.